So we are joining our broadcast right now with WBUT and WISR. So those that are listening to us on the radio, thank you very much for joining us. Those who are joining us or have been with us for a few seconds here with our Facebook Live, thank you for being here. Now, this is our conversation that we are going to have Dr. John Love with us and Dr. Rodinghouse. Tyler is producing this, so I'll give an audible to Tyler if you could go ahead and have those gentlemen join us. And as always, it's a pleasure to talk to you, and I hate to say it in this moment because I'd rather talk about other things. But Dr. John Love, thank you for your time. Dr. Rodinghouse, thank you for your time as well.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tracy.
Dr. John Love, of course, the infectious disease specialist. Dr. David Rodinghouse is the chief medical officer with the Butler Health System. And I want to start with vaccines. So let's talk a little bit about this, if we could, because Dr. Love, I'll start with you, if you don't mind. Can you give us a general sense of the process of vaccines? I know that could be a topic in and among itself, but we're talking about vaccines. I'm sure they started to try to find something for COVID-19 months ago. And now we're talking about possibly good news, which is great, but yet we're not going to see this vaccine tomorrow. So what's that process to get it to the general public?
So you're absolutely right, Tracy. This has been a process that has been going on for months. You know, it was an early effort to try to identify, basically throw in a shotgun approach at this. And the federal government made a very large push to get biotech involved early on, said basically, you know, we'd like everyone that has a potential platform for vaccination to be looking at this. You know, obviously there are huge potential financial benefits to any company that comes up with a successful vaccine. So I think everyone was game. But what we've really seen is, you know, there are multiple vaccines that are in stage two or stage three clinical trials, meaning they're to the point where they are beyond just, you know, does this really make you sick when we give it to you as a shot, to does this really work? Is this something that we could roll out for lots of people? So I think that there's, you know, we're seeing a maturation finally of months of effort. And I can't overstate, you know, how quickly this has gone compared to, you know, other vaccine developments in the past. You know, to be talking, you know, basically at a year since the first known cases of COVID-19, a year to be talking about, we have vaccine candidates that we are having discussions about how to roll out, really speaks to the technology at hand and you know, what's been able to be brought to bear on this problem.
And if I could ask you really quickly, because we're talking about Moderna making an announcement, Pfizer making an announcement, Oxford making some announcements today about some possible good news. Why are vaccines so different? Because you have Moderna saying that they could basically put this in a refrigerator and it could be kept for a while. Pfizer keeping this vaccine at minus 112 degrees. I mean, that's an incredible difference. So why are vaccines so different when they're produced?
Well, so I honestly, I don't know why these two in particular are so different, because they're both RNA vaccines. RNA is a form of nucleic acids. It's a form of genetic material. It is just very chemically unstable. It's something where if you work with it in the lab, you have to be very careful. There are lots of enzymes and lots of chemicals, including just plain water, that can lead to its degradation fairly rapidly. So RNA tends to have to be stored at very cold temperatures just to preserve it. I don't know in particular why you know, the Moderna vaccine does not require the sub-Arctic temperatures that Pfizer's does. It must have something to do with some of the preservatives and other things that are in there to stabilize the RNA. But they are both RNA-based vaccines, which we have there have been no previous RNA vaccines approved by the FDA. So this is a completely new vaccination model, a new platform, as we call it. It is much more nimble. It doesn't surprise me that the first two that we're talking about are nucleic acid based, because those are easier to produce quickly, to purify, to get out to into syringes and to study candidates. So I'm not surprised that we're talking about RNA vaccinations potentially leading the way here. But those molecules are less stable than, say, our protein-based vaccines. But, you know, Moderna has apparently found a way to keep this stable at kind of routine, you know, kitchen freezer temperature, as opposed to like a liquid nitrogen dry ice temperature.
Then let me ask both of you, and I'll stick with you, Dr. Love, for just a moment, and then I'll move on to you, Dr. Rottinghouse. But what data do you still need in order for you to feel comfortable, or are you comfortable with the announcements that are already out there? And I ask that in part because I'm curious, but also in part because I was looking at U.S. News and World Report, and they were talking about like 170 cases that they were having in this trial. And I'm thinking just 170, and then I was comparing that with the numbers in this county, let alone over the country, and it just doesn't seem like that's a lot of people. Is that enough people for a trial? And what other data are you looking for before you say, yes, we're good to go?
So, you know, I think the efficacy data is actually going to be fairly simple to come by. You know, I was looking at the Moderna data right before we went on the air. And, you know, a significant difference in infection rates between, you know, the placebo group or the people that basically got, you know, non-active vaccination versus the active vaccination. You know, really good levels of protection from what I can see with the data that's been presented, at least online. I think some of the things that we are going to be a little bit slower to get are the safety data, meaning are there long-term issues with the vaccine? You know, these with the EUA possibility with these vaccinations, meaning not having to go through the full FDA approval that most vaccines have had to do, and instead getting an emergency use authorization like we have for some other things with COVID. This is going to require probably only a couple of months of safety follow-up before the vaccine would potentially be kind of released. Most vaccine adverse events or reactions or things like that are probably going to show up in that period. It's just, you know, when we start talking about a new platform of vaccine, a new kind of vaccine that's never been used before, and we don't have that long-term follow-up data yet, there's a real conversation about, are there risks to that or not? And that's going to have to come down to how, you know, how we counsel our patients, how we counsel our providers, our staff about, you know, taking it, not taking it, you know, when are we rolling this out? Who is it safe for? You know, like everything else in medicine, there are risks that we can explain and risks that we don't know about yet. And we just have to be transparent with that.
Dr. Rottinghouse.
So, you know, the rapid development, as Dr. Love has talked about, has been impressive. And, you know, there's going to be some perhaps leaps of faith. And, you know, we have to put confidence in those folks that are the experts on producing vaccines, vetting them and then rolling them out to, you know, the general population. You know, I've heard it said before, and I think it's true, it would seem to be very difficult to develop a vaccine on the fly amidst a pandemic. But what the somewhat unfortunate and fortuitous part of that is that you have an enormous number of people who could potentially benefit from the vaccine and can make up your study group. So enrollment in the time of a pandemic with widespread disease is easier than, say, vaccinating against a disease that isn't quite as prevalent, and you have trouble finding people that are actually infected with that particular, you know, disease, organism, whatever it may be. So although there are huge challenges and there's been amazing technological advances, we're not going to have the luxury of years of safety data like we do with some, you know, of our other vaccines. The promising thing is the efficacy that's initially being reported among these is, you know, certainly exceeding the expectations of many of us who look at the public health, how we're going to achieve herd immunity primarily through vaccination. And, you know, those rates of response are very reassuring. The safety data isn't going to be there. You know, that takes a long time. But if we look at it very proactively on the fly as we're vaccinating our population, we'll gain a lot of real-time information, you know, that we can act upon quickly.
And I'm glad that we're talking about vaccines. I'm glad there's positive news that we can at least look at, but we're not going to have a vaccine again tomorrow. I just mentioned that a couple of minutes ago. So have the conversations started here in Butler County on distribution, who gets it first? I mean, that's a whole conversation in and of itself, but have those conversations started with all of you at the Butler Health System?
Well, so, you know, we've had conversations all along the way, and those have ranged from if we run out of certain equipment, run out of certain rooms, you know, what the therapies that come up. So things like remdesivir or steroids, who qualifies, who doesn't. You know, the latest drug, the monoclonal antibody that was approved from Lilly, you know, we did get an allocation of that. Question is, how do you use it? Don't ask me to pronounce the drug. It's too many vowels and consonants to run together. But, you know, the question is always going to be, how do we deploy a new therapy as it comes up? And again, in the midst of a pandemic, you're making a lot of these decisions on the fly. The most talk that I've heard is that initial efforts will be directed toward, and appropriately so, the most susceptible portion of the population. So those that we know that are at highest risk of severe illness and death from COVID-19. And, you know, those are people with chronic illnesses, nursing homes, you know, other folks that are much more susceptible to this illness. You know, certainly healthcare workers will be included in that, and other, you know, sort of essential workers was the term that was coined early on in the pandemic, to keep those people healthy, to keep them working, so we can continue to, you know, supply healthcare to our region and to our communities, and also to keep those other essential services running.
Let's turn Tracy, go ahead, so please do.
The kind of the triage that Dave is talking about, like who's going in phase one versus phase two versus, you know, potentially waiting longer. This is something that's really kind of going to be at least at the state level, if not probably the federal level. The state has already been for several weeks looking at the logistics of this deployment of a vaccine. You know, sending us questions. Basically, if we sent you 1,000 vials of vaccine that had to be used in a week because of their storage requirements, could you administer them? You know, with, you know, do you have the people? Do you have the need? Do you, you know, like, how would you could you do this? You know, as Butler Health System answers, I think with every question like this is, we will find a way. And that is just the approach that we've taken since, you know, last January when we started seeing this coming. As you said, I'm glad we're talking about this, so we have the luxury of talking about this finally. But this is not going to be like a local, like our priorities are different than, say, UPMC's versus someone else's. It's going to be more uniform than that, and decided by you know, some specialists and some epidemiologists who really are going to be applying this to the real pressure points to get the best societal benefit for a limited resource.
Since you mentioned the Department of Health, let me ask you this question, because we even reported this week in our newsroom that the Department of Health was directing healthcare facilities to start planning for a reduction in elective procedures to reduce the possible strain, whether you're talking about local hospitals or in the health care system of the state. Have you been directed to do that? And if you have, what are your decisions about that? Dr. Love, I'll address that to you first.
Sure. This is we actually last week had made the decision to suspend some non-emergent surgeries that would require an inpatient stay. We did this with an eye on our census, our bed capacity, and realizing that we were going to need just more nursing staff available to treat or to manage our sick COVID patients. And our staff is basically our most limited resource. We have more beds, we have more everything. It's our staff that is, you know, what we run out of first. So, you know, we made the decision without any direction that this is what we think we need to do to take care of our community and our patients. It's hard because we're making we're asking certain patients to defer care. You know, they may be waiting for a new hip or a new knee, something that will improve their quality of life, something that will alleviate pain. But right now we need those beds for patients who are facing a potentially life-threatening infection. And it stinks, but this is the practicality of it. You know, Dr. Levine's and the governor's messages over the last couple of days have really kind of echoed this. You know, we'd like to see health systems solve this problem themselves locally or regionally. And, you know, frankly, I think we felt that wind at our backs coming, and we just, you know, we made the decision ourselves, as we often do, a couple steps ahead. So we know what's going to be best for us and for our patients. You know, Dr. Rottinghouse does a lot of work at the regional level, coordinating with other CMOs across Western Pennsylvania. And, you know, I'll let him speak to kind of the regional approach that this fits into.
Please do, Dr. Rottinghouse.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, as Dr. Love was saying, the state, I think, is looking at this situation, you know, initially globally back in the spring when they issued, you know, uniform shutdowns and mandates. And I think that the message from, you know, other regional partners, you know, myself and other health systems across the state has been, we can coordinate responses together, but we can also do it at the micro level. You know, so as Dr. Love was talking about, we made the conscious decision to create more capacity in our health system, unfortunately at the expense of delaying certain procedures that, again, provide comfort, restore people to health and activity, and maybe back to work. But the point being that we know our population, we know our capacity, we have a much better handle on this disease now, how long people typically require treatment in the hospital. We have a better idea now of, you know, if we have X number of infections out in the community, how many of those people may need to be admitted to the hospital and what level of care they'll provide. So as long as we keep dialed in on that data and keep looking very diligently at our own census, of course, we want to provide every healthcare need necessary to our community. But we'll also do it very responsibly. And we're not afraid to step back and say, we're going to postpone certain things that can be postponed. Emergencies are always emergencies, and we'll deal with them as such. And we will deal with them in a very safe manner. Our, you know, infection prevention and infection control procedures are so much better than they were in the spring. We really know how to keep our employees and our patients safe with COVID-19. And we're very comfortable now having them in the hospital in beds while we continue to take care of other people who are non, you know, COVID infected and have other ongoing health needs. And so it's balanced, but we feel pretty comfortable with it. We feel like we've got a very good handle on it now.
Well, and I appreciate what you're saying, and I've watched other shows, of course, across the country. So you're not the only person that I've heard say we have a better handle on it. And to that point, then why are we here? Why are we still here? Why has this been 8 months later and we feel like we're back where the pandemic began? And I even say that knowing that your hospital numbers are way higher than they were at the beginning of the pandemic. You're seeing a lot more death numbers come from just November. I look back at the information from the hospital that we get quite often every other day or so, and I looked at October, and I think there were maybe two, maybe three deaths. November, just where we are right now, it was standing at about 14 people. So with 35 hospitalizations, that's such an increase. So I think it's difficult for us to understand on this end why many doctors across the country, including both of you, and I trust that you have a better handle on it, it's hard to hear that statement and then wonder, why are we still here?
Well, it's a numbers game. So, you know, back in the spring, if you were in New York or Washington, you know, state in Seattle, or you were in San Francisco or other very hard hit areas that were very population dense and, you know, COVID was well seated in those communities. And because of the proximity of people, it spread very rapidly. So, you know, if you ask some of those places what spring was like, it was a very different experience from us. And the difference was mitigation. So when we looked at the numbers, you know, coming out of China and some of the countries that were reporting data early, hospitalization rates, critical care rates, it was a scary and very unpredictable situation. So the only thing we really had in our, you know, toolbox was to fully mitigate, and that was to shut down a lot of things. So our penetration into our community and the number of positives from back then, if you look at that compared to now, although the hospitalization rate, the critical care rate, the need for, you know, emergent treatment is not quite as high. If that pool of people is, you know, multiples of what it was in the spring, you know, so say we go from, just for simple numbers sake, 100 infected people in Butler County in April to, you know, tens of thousands, you know, across the country, certainly in our area, although that pool, you know, the number of people that need to be admitted and the number of people that are going to succumb to the illness proportionally is lower, that pool of people that we're seeing now because of widespread community infection and dissemination is so large, the numbers become much more difficult to deal with. So we're just seeing a much larger group of people that are sick. And when you look at the hospitalization rates, you know, in the numbers, so say we have 34, 35, we're better at treating them. We get them out of the hospital faster. Their length of stay is much shorter than it was in the spring. So just simply looking at the raw numbers and the number of people in the hospital does not tell you the whole story, because we're moving them, you know, through the healthcare system faster, getting a lot of them better, sending them home, and unfortunately, you know, experiencing higher death rates because, or at least higher numbers of deaths, because of that total pool of patients that are coming in.
And Dr. Love, anything to add?
No, I think, you know, Dr. Roddinghouse's comment about we know how to handle this better. We know how to handle sick patients better. I think the issue here, as he said, is there has been a falling apart of mitigation efforts. You know, we are no longer anywhere near lockdown. I mean, we can't even get people to not congregate. We can't get, you know, people are racing back to crowded activities. You know, like everything that we were doing right in March and April to pump the brakes and get control over this has been to various degrees thrown out the window. So we may have better treatments, but you know, just because we have better treatments doesn't mean that we can handle a tidal wave of cases, because it's just running rampant through the community.
So you and I have talked about before, Dr. Love, dusting off this contingency plan. I know that was kind of mentioned a couple of minutes ago. So you're saying that we're not close to those contingency plans yet?
So, you know, the contingency plans, you know, including opening up off sites or things like that, you know, that those plans are always there. You know, they don't go bad. Right now we have no plan in place to do anything like that. You know, what we're trying to do is accommodate the number of patients that we need to treat within our own walls with our own usual staff. And that's our starting point for, you know, this is a goal, this is our assumption.
So I want to go through a couple of what I'll call frequent responses that I hear from the public, whether it's online, whether it's in person. And the three of us in independent conversations have had these conversations over and over and over again. But I think they're warranted to have again. But I think this adds to the COVID fatigue that I hear so much about, because people were tired of hearing it. But yet we're still here. You're still getting hospitalizations. You're still seeing deaths from this. So it's not like it's gone away. But yet people will say, hey, this is just the flu, it's no big deal. So I want to get both of your responses, first of all, from that response. Dr. Love, why don't you go ahead and go first?
So, you know, I there are similarities and dissimilarities to the flu. And I think, you know, the syndrome itself obviously has some overlap with influenza. The issue is, you know, this is really an infection that's really targeting broad sections of our population. It is, you know, we know that there are certain risk factors for having a more severe, you know, infection with it, as Dr. Roddinghouse alluded to, including age and comorbidities, you know, underlying medical problems. But, you know, a lot of people are getting sick with this. And, you know, we have people who are sick for weeks, young, healthy people who are sick and out of work for weeks. We have young, healthy people who ended up, you know, in the hospital, who've ended up in our intensive care unit. There's no one in the population who's immune to this because it's never been around before. And frankly, we also don't know what the long-term consequences of an infection with this are. You know, there are some concerning data that there are long-term damage to heart muscle and lung tissue after an infection with this virus. Is that going to play out, you know, a year from now? Is that going to be something that if you had this infection, you're going to be at a risk for more problems? I don't know yet, but I'd really rather not gamble with that. I'd really like as few people as possible at risk for that. So, you know, influenza, we have a, you know, by and large, have a pretty good handle on how to handle it, what it's going to look like, things like that. This we are learning as we go. And we are constantly being updated. There are constantly new observations and suggestions and ideas. And, you know, we're doing our best to keep up with this. This is worse than the flu in that no one has any kind of underlying protection for this. And it can really go through especially something like a nursing home very rapidly and cause a lot of morbidity and mortality very quickly.
Well, that's going to be my next question. And Dr. Rottinghouse, if you want to take this one, it's about the age, because I hear a lot of people still say this is affecting people who are in nursing homes or assisted living homes. And without violating HIPAA laws, are you able to talk about the age range of individuals that have come through the hospital who have contracted COVID and an age range of those who have passed away because of COVID?
Yeah, so, you know, the age range of those that have come in and come through the hospital, we've seen all ages. You know, so we've seen young kids test positive. We've seen, you know, people at the other extreme of age test positive. When you look at the national data and even the international data, certainly those individuals at the, you know, older end of the spectrum, you know, late 70s, 80s and on, make up the majority of the deaths by percentage and certainly by any ratio. But, you know, to Dr. Love's point, this illness spreads very rapidly through the population and also in those younger populations. And we just don't know for sure yet what, if any, long-term effects there may be. So, you know, there is evidence out there about long-term lung damage, about, you know, some possible heart damage. It's too new to the world and too new to our, you know, science and literature to know what these long-term effects are going to be. And I think probably most of us know somebody, even if they're relatively young, they're healthy, they don't have comorbidities, that have had a difficult time getting over this illness. You know, so whether it's out of work for several weeks or, you know, some other, you know, ill effects or you know, not death, but, you know, morbidities associated with it, you know, we just don't really know what those long-term effects are going to be. In terms of, you know, one of the things I hear sometimes is, well, it's an older population that's susceptible, people with multiple medical problems. When you have a novel virus or a new virus that can be spread by everyone and everyone can become infected with this because there's no inherent immunity, you know, really, as the individual goes and as small groups of people go, so does the whole population. So, you know, if 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds are spreading this, and they work in hospitals, they work in nursing homes, they work in places, you know, that serve food, their ability to disseminate it to the rest of the population is, you know, very, very great. And that risk is high. So it's up to a lot of individual responsibility. And I think Deb Bogan in the Allegheny County Department of Health spoke about this recently. You know, it's up to individuals to take responsibility for mitigating the spread of this virus. And that's true. You know, if we're going to protect those susceptible populations, then, you know, we have to care about younger people spreading it.
So that's going to lead me into Thanksgiving. That's going to lead me into Christmas. That's going to lead into New Year's. If we're not talking about a vaccine for the general public for quite a few weeks, we're talking about quite a few holidays or gatherings that we typically would get together for. So since we're right on top of the holidays, what's your opinion?
So I will... You know, so I usually give my, you know, usual song and dance about not socializing with people outside of your home, especially with eating where you can't wear a mask while you eat. All this, I am to the point now where I am just going to beg people not to have their traditional holidays with their extended families like they want. I have nothing else to do at this point. It is the perfect storm, bringing together people from multiple households into a home over a meal for extended period of time with a wide group, a wide age range. This will lead to cases. This will lead to people getting sick. It invariably will lead to hospitalizations. And I don't know how else to ask people in the same way that we have been asking for months. You know, we have cases that are directly related to family gatherings, cases that have ended up with multiple members of that gathering hospitalized, some critically so. I don't want to see people regret going through with their holidays for the sake of, you know, tradition. I hear everyone saying, well, you know, we don't want to live in fear, or, but my family's all really safe, or, you know, all these other things. And I hear it. I understand it. It's just biologically, the virus doesn't care. It doesn't care whether you believe in it or not. You know, it just, it's not going to respect your family bonds. It just doesn't care. And I, you know, my family is suspended all holiday plans if we're in person. You know, our goal is to, you know, meet via video conferencing, video phones. It's reasonable to drop food off for each other, like at your doors, without without being in person. The risk of contamination from that is really very low. So you could do, you know, sharing food and delivering it across without, you know, without being in person. But I worry this is hitting at exactly the worst time in terms of the number of cases that are already in our community. And this is going to be my suspicion is this is going to be just pouring fuel on a fire.
And while we're talking about gathering together, I know you mentioned masks. Still in favor of masks. They are still important. I assume that that's your general consensus, as we've talked about this many a times. I still see people wear them over their mouth only, nose to exposed. Some people still wear them on their chin. No joke. I'm looking at people that I'm shopping with, and they're on their chin. So what would your word, what would your message be to the community? Dr. Roddinghouse, I'll move over to you on this one.
Yeah, so, you know, we have some really good data now that masks work. You know, anecdotally, working in a hospital with, you know, lots of COVID patients that have come through here, the opportunity for transmitting that disease among each other to, you know, from patients to us, even really sick patients, are, you know, simple methods of infection control, which include a mask and frequently washing our hands, have largely kept us safe. So there's really no debating now that masks work. If, you know, we had a significant portion of the population that complied, wore them the right way, then we would probably not have to go to extreme mitigation efforts if it does come to that. We've also seen financial data, you know, from one of the big investment banks out in New York that estimated if we had very high rates of mask compliance across our country, then we possibly save the economy $1 trillion. So, you know, there's lots of reasons to do this. If I'm a public health expert looking at low rates of compliance and very high rates of cases, I only have so many things that I can do. And one is to shut down areas that cause significant amount of spread. So, you know, we often talk about, you know, sacrifices and wanting things to be back to normal. There are so many simple things that we can do to prevent spread of this illness and to avoid extreme mitigation efforts and, you know, sort of lockdowns without having a better word. And that includes, you know, distancing, avoiding get-togethers, which I know are difficult and they're hard. You know, my kids ask me about that all the time. You know, I'm a mean father because I don't allow a lot of sleepovers and gatherings anymore and that sort of thing. These are small sacrifices to make to keep our community and our country healthy. And something like a mask really isn't that big of a sacrifice for us to ask people. It's not about liberties. It's about protecting lives that should be protected and overwhelming, you know, the community with illness so that kids can go back to school, so that businesses can run, so that healthcare can be provided. You know, it's all the downstream things that we want to protect and that we want to return back to normal. But in order to get there, there's a lot of simple things that we can do well, you know, in the interim.
I want to ask about your staff here in a moment, but one question, if you are tested positive with COVID, or even if you've been in the hospital, how long should you wait until you go back to work, back out shopping, back gathering with maybe an elderly parent?
So the Department of Health guidelines say that for the majority of people, they are probably no longer, they're no longer contagious at about 10 days after their symptoms started. So that's typically the guideline we use for, you know, a relatively healthy person out in the community. There are some people that may be contagious out to about 20 days. These are people with who had either a really severe infection, people who have an underlying immunologic problem, they're immunocompromised, they're on medications for to suppress their immune system. Those people, you know, we try to extend it out to 20 days is the guideline, although it's pretty uncommon for them, you know, based on studies, to still be infectious that far out. You know, even after they've had this, they should still be masking. They should still be doing all the usual stuff. You know, it is not a golden ticket to get out of everything else that we've just were talking about. There's the recommendation is, you know, you go back to life as everyone else.
Yeah. Let me ask you about your staff. Last area, I know you both are busy, and I do appreciate your time as always. And folks, if you're just joining us now, it's Dr. Love and Dr. Rottinghouse from the Butler Health System having a conversation about COVID-19 and trying to cover as much as we possibly can. I know we could sit here all day and talk about this, but I know we can't. One question that I want to lead into the staff is, do you have patients come in that are COVID positive or who are struggling with COVID that are in denial that it's COVID? Are people believing that they actually have COVID-19?
I think we've mostly overcome that. You know, there are some people that still maybe don't have full faith in the severity and the gravity of the disease and maybe don't believe some of the statistics. You know, anecdotally, I haven't seen much of that recently. I think it's been around long enough and the data is pretty clear that we don't run into that very often anymore. More frequently, we run into, you know, perhaps people that don't want to wear a mask. I think they can't wear a mask. But I think most people understand that, you know, this disease is real, that it's prevalent. I think what we can't stress enough is the importance of everybody being a part of mitigation efforts, because it's very easy to think, you know, I'm 25, I'm young, I'm healthy, it won't have, it's unlikely to have a significant impact on me. But everyone has a role in preventing spread, an ongoing spread in our communities.
Yeah. Let me ask you about your staff. And the reason why I wanted to lead into that is because I obviously am here. You know, I talk to you and am in a radio station all day long. I'm not on the front line like you all are and your staff are. And if I'm getting the temperature of the room, if you will, outside of the hospital as people are tired and exhausted, I cannot imagine what it's like to be in your shoes or in the shoes of your staff. So how is your staff doing? Because you're in the middle of trying to care for patients, which you do so well. You're trying to be compassionate towards your patients, which you do so well. But you also have to fight the misinformation out there. And there's concern for your own health by going into these environments every single day. But you are dedicated to your job. And I know you do your job well. But there's that element, a yin-yang, that you're trying to battle every day that's got to be exhausting. So how is your staff? Dr. Love, I'll ask you first.
So, you know, I think the staff in general, obviously, we work with a terrific set of professionals who are each here to do their own jobs. You know, this whether it be nursing, or nursing assistants, or respiratory therapists, or radiology techs. Everyone is in this building to play their part in patient care, and you know, most years that's nothing to do with COVID. And we still have a lot of patient care that's going on here that's not related to COVID. Some of the staff obviously has been more taxed with COVID care than others just because of you know, where we're housing patients or the kind of care that these COVID patients require. They are dedicated. They are supporting each other in terrific ways. They are looking for ways to help shoulder the burden that has to be borne here. I've been really encouraged, you know, by people stepping up saying, you know, what can I do? You know, I see my colleagues, you know, I know they're working really hard. You know, maybe we could do X, Y, or Z, and, you know, we could offload some of that work for them. Or how do we take care of them? I think a lot of them are frustrated that we are here, that we are at this point. You know, a lot of them make the comment to me is, why won't people just wear the dang masks?
Yeah, right.
You know,
right.
And, you know, they're in there in the full space outfit, get up, you know, helping people eat, helping people go to the bathroom, giving them meds. And there's like, why do we have a ward full of these patients? Why can we not get people to understand and to do the little bit of work and help we're asking them for? And that's heartbreaking, because I don't have an answer for them. You know, Dr. Roddinghouse and I have been at months, you know, trying to get these messages out. And I think people hear them. I think, as David said, I think people understand. We've had very little, like, no, I can't possibly have COVID, or you're making that up, or that's some conspiracy. You know, I honestly have not gotten that response. But I still, you know, go to stores or go shopping or go wherever and see a bunch of people without masks.
In part why I wanted to do this, and Dr. Roddinghouse, I want to get your response as well, but I wanted to do this in part to talk to you both, because I know we live on social media all the time, and I get it, but there's a lot of cruelty out there, and there's a lot of disbelief out there, and there's a lot of misinformation out there. But for the hospital staff that's out there working, no matter if it's you all or in any hospital, there is support out there for you. You know, there are plenty of people who sit back and say, I believe in what you're saying, and I want to hear what you have to say, because it affects me and my life, and I know somebody, or I have a parent who has a comorbidity, so, you know, I need to pay attention to this. So I guess on behalf of those people that want to say we support you, I'm here to say we support you. Dr. Roddinghouse, I want to get your response as well in your staff and how you're all doing.
Yeah, you know, I think John said a lot of things perfectly. I think, you know, healthcare workers in general are, they're in healthcare because that's what they're motivated to do. They want to treat patients. They want to be an integral part of restoring health to the community. You know, there's lots and lots of literature out there on, you know, PTSD, on stressful situations. And we've provided a lot of internal resources. I think we have a lot of good open discussion. And, you know, we definitely appreciate the support of the community. And, you know, I can tell you firsthand, you know, we felt it and we appreciate it. You know, one of the things I get concerned about that we do talk about fairly frequently, and again, we've provided resources for internally, and of course, there are external resources. When you see a lot of suffering and a lot of death, you know, sometimes it's hard to do that day in and day out. And, you know, everybody has different ways of dealing with stress. I think we have to keep an eye on that. And I think, as, you know, as Dr. Love was saying, that's where the frustration comes from, is, you know, people that are working and applying that daily care, and especially, you know, our nurses, our techs, our other people who are doing the real intensive care and bedside care of these patients, they feel a sense of frustration when they say, look at what we're doing. If the public could understand, you know, the ramifications of spread in the community and the impact it has on people, they might, you know, buy into this a little bit more and just doing those simple things right. So I think our staff is in a good place right now. We're going to have ups and downs. We're going to have people that are going to reach the end of their rope, and they're going to need help, and they're going to need support. So, you know, again, it's hard to see very high levels of sickness in a population when something seems to be fairly preventable to some degree. But, you know, our staff here is very committed, is very dedicated, and we'll find a way to work through it together. But we appreciate all the support. You know, again, I think not to paraphrase John, you know, wearing a mask, you know, wear the darn mask, where do you go and do the simple things? There's going to be some short-term sacrifices, but, you know, there's promising vaccines, there's, you know, other promising things coming out. If we just do the simple things right, which a lot of other countries have done, and compare our data to theirs, if we pull back a bit and we just act responsibly as individuals, then we're going to be in a much better place over the next couple months here.
Dr. David Rodinghouse, Chief Medical Officer, also Dr. John Love, the Infectious Disease Specialist with the Butler Health System. We appreciate so much your time of being here. It's nice to be able to talk to both of you. I've talked independently to both of you on different days and different times, but thank you so much, and thank you for what you're doing.
Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tracy.
Thank you. And folks, thank you very much for joining us on our Facebook Live. Of course, you can always access our rebroadcast of this, if you will, after it is posted online through Butler Radio, WBUT, or WISR. And thank you to all of those that are listening to our broadcast as well, our simultaneous broadcast on WBUT and WISR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Tracy Morgan with Butler Radio.